This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, Richard Mabian hosts. After he speaks about his article published in the Hutchinson newspaper, he'll have a discussion with Maurice Copeland about the various whistleblowing activities he's a part of with the Kansas City Weapons Plant. But first, I'm naturally with your headline news. MSNBC.com reports, more than 18 youth plaintiffs ages 8 to 19 sued the federal government on Wednesday, walking a first-of-its-kind constitutional claim up the courthouse steps in Eugene, Oregon. The kids argue that inaction on climate change is a violation of their right to life, liberty, and property. And they demand that President Obama, seven federal departments, and the Environmental Protection Agency act immediately to preserve their climate for future generations. Julia Olson, one of the kids' lawyers, wrote in a briefing sent to MSNBC, quote, "This case presents the opportunity for a landmark decision," end quote. It asks the court to decide whether children have a constitutional right to protection from fossil fuel policies that knowingly create dangerous climate change. Olson is executive director of Our Children's Trust, an Oregon-based nonprofit that has spearheaded a climate-related lawsuits in all 50 states. Those have fallen short of success in one way or another, but this new federal filing goes further than anything the group or anyone else has filed in the past. The suit debuts a new legal framework to fight climate change, one that portrays federal support for the development and use of fossil fuels as a violation of the Fifth and Ninth Amendments, as well as the public trust doctrine. Truthout.org reports, the second largest dead zone in the world is located in the Gulf of Mexico. Excessive use of chemical fertilizers by industrial agriculture in the U.S. is one of the leading causes of the dead zone. The fertilizers, which contain phosphorus and nitrogen, generate an increase in algae, which then starves the marine life of oxygen in the water. Quote, the dead zone makes an area of the ocean floor this year about the size of Connecticut and Rhode Island combined. With oxygen levels so low, critters in these areas must swim away or suffocate and die, says Matt Rhoda, senior policy director for the Gulf Restoration Network, or GRN, an environmental group that works to protect the ecology of the Gulf of Mexico. Quote, this dead zone not only causes some mortality, but also makes it harder for fishermen to make their catch, end quote. He also stated, quote, in 2001, state and federal bureaucrats set a goal of reducing the size of the dead zone to 1,950 square miles by 2015. Well, we are at 2015, and we are over three times that goal, end quote. The EPA announced in February that since their goal was not met, they would be pushing the deadline to 2035. GRN's press release on the subject stated that no specific new strategies to ensure the new goal would be met were announced by the EPA. Thus far, the Gulf Restoration Network has won many of its arguments against the EPA in district court, which the EPA has appealed. Written arguments will likely be given around September. The WashingtonExaminer.com reports, the Obama administration gave oil company Shell approval Monday to begin tapping Arctic oil off the coast of Alaska. The approval came from the Department of Interior as the last in a series of permits that the company needs to begin doing exploratory drilling in the Arctic seas. The Interior Department had prevented Shell from drilling in oil-bearing areas off the coast of Alaska until it had a mechanism called a capping stack, which is required to prevent a well blowout that could result in a major spill. The ship carrying the stack had left the port of Seattle in recent days after receiving necessary repairs. Now that the device is in the region, Shell is being given permission to drill in areas known to have oil. And now, Mike has an update from the Independence Action Group, Save Our Neighborhoods.
Thank you very much, Natural E. So you might remember the Save Our Neighborhoods group. We had Susanna Huntoon on a couple times talking about this effort. There's a 44.6 acres of woodland around Blue Ridge between 20th and 18th that was recently sold off. The Save Our Neighborhoods group lobbied the city council to stop it because it looks like it's going to be used for a landfill or something like that. And the city council went ahead and approved the sale. So the next step left for the Save Our Neighborhoods group was to a ballot referendum. They need to get 3,600 votes, signatures on a petition from registered independent voters to get in order for that to happen. And so their deadline is this Wednesday. They had like a 3-week window, and their deadline is this Wednesday. However, I spoke with Suzanne this afternoon, and if they get 2,000 in by Wednesday, that will buy them a 10-day extension to get the remaining 1,600. So they're really working on it and really desperate for help. If folks are interested in either signing the petition or helping sign getting signatures, they do need both. You can call Mary Ann between noon and 8 p.m. Every day, and that number is 252-1559. Again, they need 2,000 signatures by this Wednesday, and then they'll have 10 more days to carry on with this. And check our Facebook page. We'll keep you posted, and they'll be posting things there as well. But it's really a daunting task, and there's a lot of people out there around the clock. They're going door to door to get signatures. And I want to call our attention to Richard Mabian wrote a piece in the Hutchinson News on how the mandatory fee is bad. And Richard, well, I'm glad you're here tonight. And first, before we get into the meat of what you and Maurice are going to talk about tonight, maybe you could tell us a little bit about this piece in the Hutchinson News.
Oh, I'll be glad to, Mike. Not that I'm one of those persons who likes to talk about himself. I'm always told by one of my good Sierra Club buddies that when you do it, don't let them think that you're talking about yourself. But I am, so here we go. First of all, hello, everybody. I'm glad to be here. I'm hosting this show tonight. I am extremely proud of this letter to the editor that got in the paper down in the Hutchinson News. From what I gather, that's a pretty powerful paper down in the somewhat mid to west part of the state.
I noticed their slogan is covering the better part of Kansas. I wonder if that refers to quality or quantity.
Yes, and that's the better part of Kansas. They discount everything east of Wichita. I think it's all, well, let's put it in Emporia. Everything east of Emporia is downhill as far as the news is concerned. But, you know, this was a situation where they had a public hearing. This had to do with Westar and Westar's attempt to increase the rates that the people in their service areas will be paying.
Westar is the energy company in that area.
It's the utility company in that part of the state. And it was interesting. I got asked to come up and speak by one of my Sierra Club folks. Plus, I got involved with a group of solar panel folks that come from California through almost D.C., and they're working with me here in Kansas, and they wanted me to come up to Topeka first and speak, and then they also wanted me to go to Wichita and speak. And pretty much what we're talking about is the fact that they have a mandatory fee that they're going to charge everybody. And the other thing is they have a fee for anyone who wants to use solar. If you put solar on your house, they charge you a fee that makes basically makes the amount of savings that you receive putting the solar on your house null and void. And so that's what this hearing was about. And it hasn't really been decided. I think it goes until the end of the month for the commissions and everyone to decide on it. But I was there representing, of course, low-income communities, and it had to deal with the mandatory fee is bad. And what I basically spoke about was that, and I'll mention that, I won't try to read the whole thing because he has a letter. We have the letter on the website so you can go see it. But the part that I thought that was so compelling, what I told him that I had, in fact, I got it in my hand. Recently, I talked with an elderly woman at church about what it was on the menu for a dinner that we was having at the church. And she said, you know, what really bothers me is I can't believe when I have to go to the store and pay a dollar for a bell pepper. And, you know, when she said that, it immediately hit me with a reality that while those of us out here just living normal lives that really not faced with being on a fixed income, we really don't see the strain that life is already starting to put on our elderly. And this Westar rate hike was designed to, I think, was by 20-something, 2017 or one of them, 2020, one of them years, was planned to increase their rates $27 a year, $27 a month, across the board, regardless. Everybody had to pay, would end up paying $27 a month. And what I was able to do with my letter and in talk and in the hearing was to make them understand that, you know, you're talking about an additional $300 on a fixed income person's salary. And the way it is right now, they find themselves, and they keep saying this, but we just, I don't think, really paying attention to it. But they keep finding themselves in a situation where they have to decide whether they're going to buy their medicine or food. You know, now you're bringing it to a point where they're going to have to decide whether they're going to buy food or have utilities on. And, you know, and that's a tough situation to put our old folks in. And that's basically what my letter was about. And they got together with me, and we got it put together and helped this company get it written up in such a way that they started shipping it around different places to get it put in the paper. And this is where it ended up. Okay?
That's great.
All righty. That's what happened, gang. If you want to see the letter, it's on the website. Just go in and check it out. Okay, now, my next part of the show is to be the to have Maurice Copeland here, who is not only a sensational person for those of us who know him, but he's also a friend. And he's an artist, and he's Kansas City's whistleblower. And I take honor in being able to know him because, as we all know, when you blow the whistle, it places you in a position where you're not the most liked person in the world. And everybody's coming after you because they want to discredit you and make it look like you just wacko. And so he's been having to live this way for some time now. So, Maurice, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Richard. I'm sorry that I was running late. We didn't have a chance to talk.
Yes, yes.
I'm here.
Okay, well, good. I'm going to tell you what. Well, I'm going to start this show off, but we're going to talk about, I want to update on the Kansas City issues that you've been involved with. Now, this is strictly about Kansas City. I talked to you a long time ago. You know where I am with this issue about y'all even being out there and what you could expect and where is it going to go and blah, 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 blah. You and I had this conversation. So I want an update to see what is it, where are we now, what's going on, what where are we? Explain to them what I'm talking about, too, for those people who haven't, are not aware of what you did.
Okay. Where we are, and I think that I should explain about the SEC, the Special Exposure Cohort, first.
Well, tell them what you did first. I'll do it. Maurice was the whistleblower for the fact that when he and other workers were at the Bendix plant, that they were making parts for nuclear weapons, bombs, A-bomb, and all that kind of stuff. They didn't make the bomb, but they made parts that went into making the bomb become a weapon. And while they were out there dealing with that, they ended up having a series of chemicals that no one really taught them how to work around or explain to them the long-range possibilities of being around that particular chemical. Those of us, and that you've heard on here before, that are working with the diesel emission problem out in Argentina are trying to warn residents of the extent of the problems that can be associated with the emission of that diesel into the air where they live and the circumstances of that being there. Well, when they were working over at the Bendix plant, no one ever sit out and told them they were working around the kind of chemicals that could in later in life cause them to have cancers and all kinds of cardiovascular diseases and the whole bit. And then Maurice found out about it somehow. And when he did, he went public. And that's where the whistleblowing came from. And so his life has been a living hell ever since he did that. So they've been in court, out of court, farm groups. They've been protesting. They've been out there doing all kind of stuff. Now, come on, bring us up to date.
Yeah, and the way I found out about it is that the government admitted it. They admitted it flat out. They admitted it with a presidential executive order that I know that people are very familiar with now because Obama's writing plenty of them. Bill Clinton put on the table when he left office in 2000, he put on the table for the Republicans, I think he did it to pull the trick on Bush, and said, look, we made these people sick. We made them sick without their knowledge. He wrote a beautiful act. He told the truth. And he of course, afforded the people the medical coverage and a monetary payoff. Not a payoff, but some monetary benefits because you expend a lot of money on your health care while you work at Bendix. Now, that's what Bill Clinton did. He put it on the table. Of course, Bush affected it because he's in office, and they didn't do a very good job. They introduced it to the plant, but in introducing it to the plant, I was in management, introducing it to the plant, they are giving me, as a manager, and the manager's instructions on how to take this back to the people, to the workers. And in doing so, within 15 minutes of their introduction to us of the program, they told a fib. They did not tell the truth. And I questioned that. I said, tell me what you just said. They said, we only use, and this is a certain element out there. They said, at Honeywell, we only use 2% beryllium at Bendix. Well, that was far from the truth. And I stopped them. I said, no. I said, go back. We got a room full of people here. We got a room full of managers. So these people, some of these people have been there longer than me. I worked there 32 years. And I said, no, I can't do that. I can't go back and tell these people that because it's not true. And they said, well, Copeland, that's all we got. That's the only paperwork that we have. We only use 2% beryllium. I said, you go back. I said, look in 1974, and I think you will see something different. They went on with the meeting. Of course, when you start on the first page and you tell an untruth, the rest of the book is not going to be quite correct.
Right.
So they came back at the second meeting. This is before we introduced it to the population, to the workers. As soon as they walked in, they didn't even get to the podium. They said, well, we want to correct something right quick. We use 100% beryllium out here, and that was it. Now, how can you go from a 2% to 100%? You know, and so I got a problem. Now, subsequently, that was in August. And
what year?
Of 1999.
Okay.
And I was out of there in February of 2000.
Okay. Now, that's the story that got him started. And then he decided to step up to the plate and make it known what had happened. Now, they've been through a lot of gyrations out there, but where are we today?
Okay, today I want to say something brief about the SEC. The SEC is a special exposure cohort. And in the Act, the Energy Employees Occupational Illness Act, which President Clinton introduced, there's a provision for what they call a SEC, special exposure cohort. Special exposure cohort would give the people that worked in the plant, and this deals with radiation illnesses. We don't talk too much about that at Honeywell because y'all have already been told that Honeywell is a non-nuclear plant. Well, Honeywell is also a plant that is umbrellaed, one of the largest umbrellas you're going to get, of national security. And we're not going to tell you what we did at Honeywell. You're not going to know if we handled radiation or not. We can tell you anything because we're under national security. Now, I'm here to tell you that, yes, we did handle nuclear material at Honeywell. Yes, we did. And, yes, we also generated. And this is the hell that I catch. And it's true. We also generated a certain amount of radioactive materials at Honeywell. They don't like that. I don't care. Okay? So the SEC, I'm going through the process. I put in for what they call the SEC to pay people for one of 22 cancers, 22 cancers on the list under the act. That if we get this SEC that I applied for, it will pay anyone and also give them full medical coverage that had one of those 22 cancers, okay? And we've been going through this for the last well over 2 years. The decision was supposed to have been made 180 days after I submitted for the SEC. We're on 2 years and 180 days that they've kept delaying this. Now, if they're so confident that Honeywell is not a radioactive plant, we did not handle the radioactive material, why would it take them so long to make a decision on if they should grant it or not? You either grant it or you don't. You say that we're a non-nuclear plant, we didn't have nuclear materials. Why are you taking so long to either deny it or grant it? Because they know that we handled, over the legacy and the years of that plant, we're not going to tell you what we did at Honeywell.
Okay, you know, we're going to take a break here a second, be right back.
Yeah, before we do, just a point of clarification. So you, our listeners who may be new to the Kansas City area, hear us refer to Bendix, to Honeywell, to Allied Signal. That's all the same thing. That's all the same plant. It's just been under different operations over the years. So just want to clear that point up. And then I really want to mention a couple things coming up along the lines of programs on KKFI along this same subject matter. So Wednesday morning at 5 on From the Vault, an original radio adaptation of John Hersey's Hiroshima, starring Tyne Daly, Ruby Dee, and Roscoe Lee Brown. That airs Wednesday morning at 5 p.m. This was originally aired in the early 60s, I believe. And then also on Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer on Thursday morning, Tom sits down with Richard Rhodes, and Richard Rhodes is a Kansas City native, and he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author of How to Make an Atomic Bomb. And he was here. He spoke in Independence, the home of Harry Truman, on the 70th anniversary of Nagasaki. And so we'll hear excerpts from his talk as well as when Tom had a chance to sit down with him. And we'll be back with more with Maurice Copeland and Richard Mabian after these messages.
All right, I'm back here with Maurice Copeland, and he's Phil. And that was good, Mike. That was perfect timing on those other events that's going to be going on here in and around Kansas City, folks. I mean, here we are again. It's just like on the black issue, as far as that movie came out with about Compton, and they showing how what they were doing with the young black men back in the 60s and 70s or whenever it was. They still having the same kind of circumstances going on here in the 2015. So, and just like what we're talking about now, this nuclear weapons concern and issue, you know, what's going on with Obama and them over in Iraq and all that kind of stuff is putting us in a position where that all of that stuff can become an issue again with us, and not going to them, coming to us. We have to start being again educating ourselves on what we're talking about. We can't allow what happened at Bendix to happen again up under our noses, and we know nothing about it. So I thank God for Maurice for being in a position that he stepped up to the plate to do what he does. Now finish me up about the SEC.
SEC. Special Exposure Cohort.
Okay.
what's going on with the Special Exposure Card. I just got back from Cincinnati, and these are the meetings where they've been deciding if they're going to grant the SEC. That's the 22 cancers. Everyone will be taken care of from 1949 to 1993. 1993 was the cutoff date that I had to agree to. Excuse me. And I agree to. We've been doing this for over two years. And I'm sorry, Kansas City, but I want these people to go on and make the decision. I want them to make the decision if they're going to grant it or if they're not going to grant it. That's what I want. It's too long. These people seem to be, and I'm talking about NIOSH, the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, and NNSA, Honeywell, and their Labor Department. I think they're just milking a cow and making money, having these meetings in nice little hotels. I'm tired of it. So it's time for them to make a decision one way or the other and let me loose, because until they make a decision, I can't do anything else to educate you people. I just have to sit back and let them make the decision one way or the other to grant it or not, and then we can do some more fighting.
Okay. There's one more part I want to bring up before we move on. Since the last time Maurice was here, his wife passed. And she passed from circumstances that could very easily be related to the chemicals that he had on him when he left work going home. They didn't allow them to take showers and change clothes. So when they left the plant, they went home wearing the clothes that they had at the plant. I remember when I was in the military and the guys would go home off the training fields, and they would have, like especially the ones that worked in the gas chambers, and how they would talk about how their wife would be cleaning up their clothes and stuff, and when they start ironing them, all that gas would come up in their face and they sit at home. Well, that could very easily have happened to Maurice's wife.
Yeah.
And I just have to tell you, she just hasn't been that long. How long has it been?
May.
It's just May. He lost her in May. After a long illness. I remember when she first got ill, he came back and said she's never smoked, and she's got all of these smoking-like circumstances and cancers and stuff. And so, you know, he's an example of what's been happening to all of those employees who've been out there working. And they're dying. I mean, they're dying, man. I mean, it's amazing how many of them are just because of these illnesses dying. And the federal government is doing nothing but sitting around procrastinating and acting like, I mean, come on. When you go from one meeting saying that you only use 2%, and then you come back to the next meeting and say, oh, we made a mistake, it was 100%. I mean, I ain't know 2% to 5%, but 2% to 100%, that's ridiculous. And that's what they've been dealing with. I have lots of problem with the fact that the environmental community is not embracing Maurice. A lot of problems. In fact, I'm probably the only person that really comes on the air and talks to him because they don't want to be bothered with him. They're tired of hearing the story. It's over and over and over. It's like he's just saying the same thing. Well, what are you supposed to do? It would make sense to me that that's what you're supposed to do. So I want to, first of all, Maurice, as I always do, congratulate you on doing what you're doing. And out there in the world where we work now, we need more whistleblowers. I mean, whether you know it or not, we really do. We need more people to step up to the plate and admit what's really going on these jobs that we don't know about. I know it's taking a chance. You'll be an oddball. You'll lose your job. You see how quick they got rid of me as soon as they said something. That's what happens. But I'm saying, we as the American public, you can say what you want to about Donald Trump. And, I mean, he's got a lot of thing about him that's not right. But the one thing about him that he's doing is exposing the corruptness that's going on in the political systems that we live and work in. And you know, and that's something that we just have not had. And everybody's making up excuses for him doing what he's doing when it's just that he's in a position where he don't have to depend on nobody, so he can say what the heck he wants to say. And that's what this whistleblowing is all about. That's also the way that I've carried myself in the environmental movement. That's why you don't see me sitting in those top-heavy positions and making all the money that I really should be making for what I'm doing, because people who speak the truth are not necessarily the ones that they want in charge or around programs. So, Maurice, you know, I thank you for that. Now, the reason I got him on here today is another problem. Another totally different problem. Thank God Kansas City is not in our city. So we can, well, we don't know. It may be. It hasn't been exposed here yet. Also, I'm going to open up the lines here just in case anybody's got any questions. The line here at the studio is 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534. If you got anything you want to add to this, you got a question you want to ask or something you need to know, give us a holler, okay? Now, this next problem involves something that was going on in St. Louis. All right, now fill us in on that.
Well, it's a big problem in St. Louis. I mean, people don't realize how big it is. Let me just give you a piece right quick. I put out the news, and I got the news through the social media and everything like everybody else does. Years ago, it was about a situation where they sprayed the projects down in Pruitt-Igoe in St. Louis with radioactive, biological, and chemical materials, and they did it expressly to see the effect on the people, and they called the people slum dwellers. This was in the 1950s, 60s, okay? They sprayed the people. I want people to understand this because people don't seem to get it.
No.
They sprayed the people. This was an army operation. Mm. They sprayed the people with radioactive chemical materials, and you can punch it up on your computer. All you got to say is St. Louis spray, punch it up, and listen. Now, the problem in St. Louis as it relates to Honeywell here in Kansas City, I just came back from St. Louis, and I viewed a documentary that they did about the Mallinckrodt industry,
yeah,
who was a supplier of the nuclear materials to Kansas City. Okay? They supplied us with the nuclear materials that we had. Okay? St. Louis did the same thing that I did about the SEC. It was carried on by a lady named Denise Sprott. She got the SEC. This is a fight. This was a fight for her. Okay? Just like it is for me. They took her in. And she went to work for NIOSH. This lady is still committed. She put out a documentary on what it took for her to do what she did. In doing so, she also exposed the chemicals that were held back during the 50s up in northern St. Louis. And the name of her documentary was The Other Side of the Fence. If you can imagine. Weldon Springs. A lot of people may know about Weldon Springs. Weldon Springs is like Times Beach. It's dead. The area is dead. You can't do anything on that area. It's dead. Well, across the fence, and I literally mean across the fence, is a neighborhood of people that have been there the whole time. And they've been dying the whole time. And that area, Clear Creek, which runs through northern St. Louis. The people have found cancer clusters and everything else, and they have moved on this project. They've moved on it, and they're getting some action. They're getting some attention with the help of her film that she put out, The Other Side of the Fence. I'm trying to bring that to Kansas City.
Okay, so let's back up here.
I'm trying to bring it here.
You're saying that during the 50s, early 60s, I suppose, mm-hmm. that as an experiment to see the effects of these chemicals, they intentionally sprayed a black community, low-income community,
yep.
to sit back and watch and see what would happen. For those of you who don't know about St. Louis, Pure Igo is where the Spinks brothers came from. The Boxers, for those of you old enough to remember them, both Michael and what was the other one's name?
Leon.
Michael and Leon Spinks. Both of them grew up in Pure Igo. When I was the social servant, I was dealing with court-committed juveniles in three blocks from where Pure Igo had been. When I got there, they had torn most of it down. But I spent time in that neighborhood that he's talking about. It was a very unusual neighborhood. And, you know, who knows? I might have picked up stuff while I was around there because I was engaged in that part of town breathing that air. So they did this. That's kind of like the syphilis test they did on brothers and stuff back in the day. So they still in the position that they can do those kind of things using the black community. And I don't want to put this just on black community anymore. I'm going to put it on low-income, multiculturally low-income communities, even though back then it was probably all black. That means today the multicultural community that involved my Hispanic brothers and sisters and my low-income white brothers and sisters, along with your black and also some of the foreign folks just moving into this country, Wyandotte County, we got all of that, could very easily be selected as one of those places to do that.
That's right. And not only that, the fact of the matter is one of the first people that stepped up, think about it, were white people that were in the Pruitt-Igo area because they were maintenance men and their families stepped up. That was the first people that I saw talking about it on TV.
This is unreal. Okay. Now, so this lady somehow ended up doing a documentary, okay? And she explained, just like if you had the resources to be able to do a documentary on what you experienced, you could do one of those for Otis Bendix. Right? See, that's the difference, folks, when they talk about resources. They talk about education and opportunity. You know, there's some folks living in this country that are in a position, and I'm not going to deal with it racially now, but you know that that's what it basically boils down to. But there are certain people in this country who have the resources to be able to go out and make documentaries, get the support they need behind them. And you can make a documentary and it can sit on the shelf from now on. But she not only made it, she got it seen.
Right. And you will see it here in Kansas City.
She got it seen. So that's saying that she had the ability or the support mechanism to be able to do that, which is something that we have missing. Okay, so now, so what's going on in... Tell me about, I know the documentary, and you keep jumping to the point we're going to be able to see it in Kansas City, but who's this brother that you talked about up there in St. Louis? Who is he?
Tim West is the producer and videographer that made the film. And the film is currently in film festivals. So he applied for the film festival in Kansas somewhere, and that's what I've been waiting on to see. They got to release it out of the film festivals or let me know if he's going to get it in the film festival in Kansas, wherever it is in Kansas. I thought it was Kansas City, Kansas, but I don't know.
The Kansas Film Festival, I think, is held in the old Metcalf South.
At
least it was.
We was in one there with another film.
So will you know ahead of time when it's going to be there?
That
we can put on our website, Mike, or we can announce and stuff to make people aware of it. So if you see it on there, folks, you'll know what we're talking about, and you can always, maybe we'll put some blurb on there when they can go back to this particular show and get the update of what we're talking about. We can do that, can't we?
Absolutely.
All right, we'll set it up in such a way that once we get it on there, we'll announce it from here. You can go in on the website and see it.
Well, on our Facebook page at least.
Okay.
Yeah. Hey, we should probably take our second break now so we can continue with the show.
All right, buddy. We'll be right back,
gang. We'll be right back,
yeah. All right, gang, I'm back again. We're getting ready to wrap this show up. This is the last segment. And for those of you who haven't been there, first of all, I'll put the number out again, 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534. So where we are right now is we've discovered that there's a chemical that was during the 50s and early 60s was sprayed over a black community at Puerto in St. Louis, and the white workers who were maintenance folks at the project, which was that's what it was, a public housing, one of those high rises is what it was, the old kind of project with the breezeways and all the evil stuff that went on in Panda places. You mentioned a word that they use. What do they call them? Slum what?
Slum dwellers.
Slum dwellers, yeah. Call them slum dwellers. Well, anyhow, some lady, as Maurice had done here, found a way to become a whistleblower, and they've created a documentary. Now, that documentary, is it showing in St. Louis?
Is it shown in St. Louis? Oh, yeah, it's shown in
St. Louis. Did you go there and see the documentary?
Yes, I did.
Okay, now you were telling us something about Mallinckrodt.
Mallinckrodt is a company that supplies the nuclear weapons industry with radioactive materials. They're like the go-between company. You got the fissile, the plants that make the materials, like Paducah, Metropolis, Illinois. All of these places are right together. I want people to understand this. This has really been an education for me. The plants that supply us with our nuclear materials are close together, and they're in rural and poor sections of the state and the city. Oak Ridge, Tennessee was terrible and tremendously big. They made this community up. 75,000 people they brought into this community and made this community like overnight. Okay? Tennessee, Kentucky, Illinois. All of these plants are in close proximity to one another. And they're nasty. They're nasty plants. They produce the uranium. They mix the stuff up. And it is killing those people. I went and visited those people, and it breaks my heart because I see what's going on. And the government has, like I said, Bill Clinton wrote a beautiful, he did a good job in writing this act. But the government has put up roadblocks not to do what Bill Clinton says do. And that's to fess up and be up front and be climate friendly to these people. Now, we have to prove that these people exposed us to this stuff. Why do we have to prove it when they already admitted it? And this is terrible what they're doing.
Yeah.
And there's other things in there that, that you know, I wish we had more time to talk about.
Yeah, okay, you went to see the movie.
Yeah.
And that's where you, while watching it and them talking about Mallinckrodt, you discovered...
Weldon Springs?
Yeah. No, the company. You saw you...
Mallinckrodt.
No, Kansas City Company on there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, yeah, that was just... I don't know what did that. They showed the Honeywell plant. The Honeywell plant. I'm looking for Mallinckrodt, the factory, and bam, there's a picture of Honeywell. Why did she do that? I don't want to get her in trouble. She's still working for NIOSH, you know, but I'm glad she did that. So if it ever comes to Kansas City, yes, this is about St. Louis, but it's subliminal maybe.
Yeah.
But look, and you will see Honeywell plant flash across the screen.
You know,
beautiful.
All of us that around our ages know people who worked at Honeywell. And I've known people who worked at Honeywell. Many of them died with cancer. Many of them did. And they smoked. I mean, that which didn't benefit the situation, did it? But so the people just assumed that the cancer came from them smoking. I had a landlord one time that worked out there, man.
Richard,
he didn't last at all.
Richard.
Yeah.
I was a supervisor. You could not step outside of your workplace and smoke. You had to smoke at your workplace. It's not like people wanted to smoke around this stuff. They made you smoke. You would be fired if you lit a cigarette in the hallway and stand in the hallway. You go back to your workstation. You go to the safety crib. check out an ashtray, sit it on your machine, and work around benzene, toluene, trichloroethylene. I required my people to do that. I gave my people poison in their hands. Any supervisor that anywhere, anytime, any day, face me and let's tell the truth. I put poison in my people's hands, along with their little candy bar and their Coke to sit on the end of their machine and let the petroleum products and the spray mist spray all around it. Get the films in their Coke. I did that, and everyone else did too.
Yeah, the thing about it is that no one else really besides yourself is stepping up to the plate to admit that this stuff was going on, and you think you would have more of that. I mean, it's just obvious that what you said is true. I mean, because those chemicals were there. Those chemicals were there, and that in itself shows that that plant was a problem. Okay, so now the film's going to come to Kansas City one of these days. We showing somewhere like Trivial Theater or something like that. What do you think it might be showing?
What did you say, Mike?
At the Kansas Film Festival has been at Metcalf South.
Right. Okay. Yeah, we'll keep our eye on that for you. Again, Maurice, I can't say enough about what you're doing, and I'm just saying to the folks out there that they need to be aware of the fact that these kind of things are going on in our city and in and around us. I mean, you know, they're still doing. For instance, no one told anybody that the the thing that was killing us last year, and everybody had them in the hospital. The Ebola outbreak, when the guy in Oklahoma City, the first one that they had, not Oklahoma City, in Dallas. In fact, Foose and I were in Dallas the weekend that they had that guy locked up in the hospital that had happened. You know how the nurses and stuff all ended up being contaminated by it. But no one told us that the chemical, that the Ebola
virus,
the waste, the Ebola waste that came from that man was put in containers and shipped to Kansas City, Kansas, to the medical waste facility. No one said a word to anybody. So you know that we're still living in a world where those kind of things are going on. I'm not going to mention who told me this. I just said it was of sound logic that they were meeting with the railroads because they're shipping toxic waste through Kansas City and not telling anybody. And they're supposed to inform key people. They're not doing it. So, I mean, as we sit and as we talk, okay, Maurice, I'm going to wrap this up.
KKFI.
Okay, I'm going to wrap this up. What are you wanting to say?
I want to thank KKFI. Do you know how long y'all been with me on this?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so give me my little accolades.
Yeah.
I wouldn't been able to do anything. Y'all, KKFI, and I can name the programs and the people. Right. Y'all have been faithful. You know, come on.
Yeah.
Give it to yourself.
Yeah, I agree. We have been the ones that are doing it. And there's other organizations in town that have worked with you on this. We want to thank each and every one of them because they are our saviors as far as that is concerned, as far as making this known to us and as far as making people step up to the plate. They've got some have gone to jail. Some have died, but some have gone to jail fighting this cause by doing various non-discriminatory things. All right, gang. Thank you. Appreciate you, Maurice, coming in and giving us the update. I'll always have you in from time to time just to do that. Rest of you, see you when I see you. Take care now.
Hi, everybody. This is Naturally again, and I have a couple of environmental events for you. August 18th, so tomorrow at 8 a.m. to 10:30 a.m., there is an event put on by Bridging the Gap. Has the region reduced its impact on climate change? Johnson County, Kansas, and Kansas City, Missouri recently collaborated to track greenhouse gas emissions. Representatives from both cities will present their findings at Bridging the Gap's next Green Business Network event on Tuesday, August 18th. This event will include a sustainable tour of Union Station. Highlights include a revamped recycling program and expanded environmental curriculum for Science City. It will be at Union Station 30 West Pershing Road, Kansas City, Missouri. The event is free for current Green Business Network members. Members and non-members alike can register at the link posted on our Eco Radio Facebook page. And the Master Gardeners of Greater Kansas City present Critter Control for Urban Gardens with Todd Mees, Missouri Department of Conservation Wildlife Biologist. Mees will talk about the animals we typically encounter in our urban environment, and he will discuss some more exotic wildlife and recommended ways to manage nuisance wildlife. This free event will be held 6:30 p.m. Thursday, August 20th at the Kauffman Foundation Conference Center, which is located at 4801 Rock Hill Road. This event is open to the public and no registration is required, but for more information, visit mggkc.org.
And now we're going to go out with World Ocean Radio.
World Ocean Radio.
Radio Yabahari Dunia.
Radio de l'Océan.
La Radio Océano del Mundo.
Champion de l'Océan.
Sayansi Bahari.
Solutions to today's ocean issues.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio.
I'm Peter Neal, Director of the World Ocean Observatory. The present drought in California, in the United States, is a highly visible realization of our lack of water awareness and its destructive undermining of the financial structure and social organization we have built in that most progressive state, in that most successful global economy. If we fail in California, how can we succeed anywhere else? At the most reductive level, the traditional water supply system in California has been overwhelmed by climate, industrial agriculture, and water-rich consumption that has been the envy of the world, but can survive no longer without revolutionary change. If there's not enough water on the mountaintops to feed the watershed, rivers, and reservoirs, then where will the requisite water come from? In 2012, the San Diego County Water Authority signed an agreement to build the largest desalination plant in the United States. The process is not new. It is applied today in some 21,000 desal plants in over 120 countries, including Italy, Australia, Spain, Greece, Portugal, Japan, China, India, United Arab Emirates, Malta, Cape Verde, and Cyprus, producing more than 3.5 billion gallons of potable water per day. Saudi Arabia leads the world, meeting 70% of the daily needs of its population. The San Diego project is proposed to come online in 2015 and to provide 7% of the authority's demand by 2020. The plant is to be built and operated by Poseidon Water, a private investor-owned company that develops water and wastewater infrastructure. The contract is for 30 years, after which the authority can purchase the plant for $1. The company is also building a 10-mile pipeline to deliver treated water inland to the authority's aqueduct system, where it can augment existing collected or natural supply to serve the needs of the 24 regional member water agencies serving 3.1 million people. The plant occupies 6 acres of the 388-acre oceanfront site of the Encina Power Station that for 50 years has run on oil and natural gas, releasing emissions and requiring a large dredged lagoon to hold seawater for cooling and to receive plant effluent, a stagnant, stinking reminder of an old technology. The adjacent desalination plant will use a reverse osmosis process with its source water coming from the generating plant cooling supply, treated and pumped under pressure through membranes to remove salt and other microscopic impurities. In the past, the primary objections to desalination has been salt residue, corrosion, habitat destruction, and cost. The Poseidon plant has undergone comprehensive review by the local, state, and federal agencies, each determined to protect its constituents and the environment. For every 2 gallons treated, one will be quality drinking water and the other diluted salt content for return to the ocean. The plant will run on Encina electricity to power high-speed pumps at market rates built into the contract. The approvals indicate that there will be no noise, no odor, and no environmental impact. Remarkably, the surrounding land has already been renewed by the prospect of the new plant and has been redeveloped by the authority to transform the embayment into a viable environment for marine life and community activities. The San Diego region has been a center for the development of international desalination technology. The reverse osmosis process was born from a local company in the 1960s. There are some 35 related companies in the area, employing 2,200 people and generating over $200 million in annual revenue. According to the authority, the Poseidon project, quote, will have significant economic benefit for the region, including $350 million in spending during construction, 2,400 construction-related jobs, and $50 million in annual spending throughout the region once the desalination plant is operational. For the region, the facility will create jobs, generate tax revenue, improve water quality, and enhance water reliability with a new drought-proof supply, unquote. Drought-proof. These hopeful numbers and language are the typical political arguments that have been used to justify new technology for a long time. The financial estimates may or may not be predictable or accurate, but the ultimate return is inevitable. When there is suddenly no more water available, we need the salt water turned fresh, and the cost is priceless. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
World Ocean Radio is produced by the World Ocean Observatory in association with WERU-FM, Blue Hill, Maine. Find our podcast on iTunes and at worldoceanobservatory.org.